Why do more media professionals read iwantmedia.com? iwantmedia.com features reports from industry leaders and media personalities. iwantmedia.com gives you quick access to news, stats, trade orgs, and industry publications, and it's updated daily. Forbes says iwantmedia.com contains everything media professionals need to stay ahead of the game. The Washington Post calls it the source for the serious media geek. Do you get it? If you don't, you should. To sign up for free daily email alerts, visit iwantmedia.com.
Welcome to The Advertising Show, America's only radio program focusing on advertising, media, marketing, product development, branding, new media, sales and customer relations. Stay with us for entertaining marketing discussion and our special guest interview. Now, here are your hosts, Ray Schillens and Brad Forsyth.
It's The Advertising Show once again, and we are so glad that you're here. Ray Schillens, Brad Forsyth. Advertising Show being brought to you by Advertising Age Magazine. Visit online at adage.com. The Advertising Show is a copyrighted Big Radio Midgets production. Nick Covey is joining us out of Chicago today. Nick is the director of cross-platform insights for the Nielsen Company, responsible for cross-platform media insights. Nielsen, working across the global portfolio of research, is charged with delivering new insights on media. The connected consumer. His research is widely quoted. You read at the bottom of the Wall Street Journal, all the way to BBC News. So we've got Nick in just a little while. We've got Jeremy Kent today, here momentarily, is going to be talking about the Brits, who seem to be watching more TV and enjoying more Pringles. So we'll see what happens there. Jeremy Kent is our European correspondent as well. Gene Bliss, a little bit later on in the hour. Nurse Next Door is obviously a nurse facility placing nurses in homes. And basically what she's going to talk about today is humble pie. And would you like that with alamo or cheese, whatever you want there. So that's Gene Bliss and Jeremy here in just a few moments. And, of course, Nick comes your way, too, here at the Advertising Show. So good to see you. How you doing, Brad?
Well, doing great. I always like to follow up your nice open that you always do with a reminder that everyone can subscribe if you're so inclined to The Advertising Show. Many of you are already subscribing, but go to the iTunes, check out The Advertising Show subscription button, click on. You want to write something about our show, you can weigh in there as well. You want to write something unfavorable, I would say go to abc.com or hulu.com and check out The Advertising Show there if you want to write something unfavorable.
No,
favorable,
that's okay.
iTunes.
We take it. We take the good with the
true.
Bad.
And a reminder that the wonderful job that Varanji and Ariel are doing, both producers of the show, with our social media at Twitter, which, of course, is at The Ad Show, is where you can find us, or Facebook if you're interested. But anyway, doing great here, Ray, and wanted to ask you, are you growing a beard, or is that just a 5 o'clock shadow we're seeing today?
It is a 5 o'clock shadow, and I'm glad you noticed that. How does it look? Pretty good?
Doesn't look bad from here, but, you know, on the other hand, I've always liked the day two growth that you do, especially when your wife's gone.
It's my Eric Clapton look. Okay, that's what it is, man.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
By the way, speaking of music, Eric Clapton, as we do say, Madison Avenue basically is using musical comfort food. And what could that be? Well, it could be a variety of things for a lot of people. But what they're suggesting is Rodgers and Hammerstein, The Sound of Music, and other mainstay musicals like Carousel, The King and I, Oklahoma, South Pacific. And more than a dozen marketers are using, the Rodgers and Hammerstein stuff, the rival package, Good Giants, Procter & Gamble. Unilever seldom agree on anything they say, but they are harmoniously singing the praises of the R&H team. Procter ran a commercial during the Vancouver Winter Olympics. You'll Never Walk Alone, that's from Carousel. Well, the Dove line of hair care products sold Unilever by using My Favorite Things, The Sound of Music, for a television and online campaign. So it's kind of interesting. Comfort music, musical comfort food, they're calling it. And I think it's kind of cool. Here's another one. Gosh, what is it? 16 Going on 17, The Sound of Music. That is Hyundai, State Farm. State Farm spot stopped at the end of March. The Hyundai is still appearing, though. Whatever you're looking for, think of, you know, as part of your creative, think of something a little bit more. Think of the fact that your listeners or your consumers or your potential consumers want to hear musical comfort food. Doesn't that sound nice?
Let me out of this elevator, for God's sakes. I thought Muzak had gone away. Here it's back, and Madison Avenue is using it, actually.
Yeah, Muzak is definitely not gone away. And yeah. And they're, you know, it's funny, but you say Muzak, you think elevator music. But apparently Muzak is really held their own over the years. And, of course, if you want elevator music, I'm sure they have it for you somewhere.
No, you're right. I saw a piece on that. I think it was on 60 Minutes where they showed all the different types of music that Muzak offers. And, of course, if you're a restaurant or a department store, you already know Muzak or one of their competitors because you probably use that. But you're right. It's not your grandmother's elevator music anymore at Muzak. They do a good job.
You know, it's funny, too. XM Sirius, the same thing in restaurants. That's a big thing. And a lot of other resources as well that provide the opportunity to not only provide music, but you can day part the music. You can segment the music to cause people to eat faster by pumping up the beat, as we talked about. I think it was last week we talked about that, but it's quite cool to see what you can create these days. So I guess Muzak would be the granddaddy of all the folks out there, right? Something like that. Go ahead. We've got about a minute before Jeremy.
Well, real quickly, this is, I thought, kind of a strange piece. Amid print media's many struggles, of course, polling by the Chief Marketing Officer Council finds people who subscribe to magazines are loyal to the medium and in no hurry to migrate to online versions. Also, many of these people say magazine ads, lead them to advertisers' websites. I don't know about you, but... And, of course, that kind of information, when you hear that, it's probably put out by the Magazine Publishers Association. Yeah. I don't know. But I don't know about you, but going online and checking out magazines online is just so much easier for me. I'm sure it is for you too, Ray. And we're going to talk about this and a whole bunch of other things with Nick today, our guest. But, I don't know. Of course, you would go check out a website if you saw their URL in a print ad. I think most of us do that these days, regardless.
It would
right?
make, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely right. Yeah. Interesting. By the way, Jeremy Kent is with us here live out of London. Well, kind of live. He's put this report together. Let's find out what's going on in Europe as far as television watching goes. And don't forget about the Pringles as well. That's coming up next, right now, as a matter of fact, in the Advertising Show.
Hello, I'm Jeremy Kent, and welcome to the European News Desk. This week, Jimmy Choo slips into Foursquare, Pringles has a pop at social media, and the British are watching more TV. Jimmy Choo, the top-end shoe brand, is using location-based social media tool Foursquare to run a treasure hunt across London. Until now, Foursquare has primarily been used to check people in at locations, but this time a pair of trainers from Jimmy Choo's new range will check in at chic hotspots around town, but they won't be around for long. If you're the first to catch them before they move on, then you can win a brand new pair of your own. Staying with social media, Pringles has developed its sharing proposition and has begun poking some fun at social media nuts. The Oversharers campaign, developed by Wonderman, centres on the idea that people who post banal trivia on Facebook and Twitter are actually boring their friends and encourages them to think about what's really worth sharing, like, yeah, you guessed it, Pringles. A new website will showcase some of the worst tweets and posts and allow visitors to download an overshare button for Facebook. At the moment, Facebook provides you with the option to like or comment on a friend's post, but the overshare button provides a third alternative. When pressed, the author of the update receives a message suggesting they seek help at the Pringles website. The campaign will be supported by Viral and other initiatives, and it'll be interesting to see if it is firstly well received and embraced by the public, and secondly, if the idea really takes off, where it might take the Pringles brand. Finally, just as social media evangelists are heralding the death of TV, a new report claims that the British are actually watching more television. According to Thinkbox, weekly viewing figures for linear broadcast TV rose to 30 hours and 4 minutes over the last quarter. That's an increase of 2 hours 29 minutes over the same period last year. In the UK, the BBC provides a public broadcasting service that is advertising free. However, commercial television accounted for 61.5% of total viewing last quarter, up 1 hour per week on the same period in 2009. During those 18 hours and 29 minutes of commercial television consumed every week, the average British viewer watched 48 ads a day. That's up 3 on last year. This is Jeremy Kent in London for The Advertising Show.
Hey, thanks, Jeremy. On The Advertising Show with Ray Shillings and Brad Forsyth, we promised you Nick Covey. Out of Chicago, director of cross-platform insights, the Nielsen Company. In recent years, Nick has managed Nielsen's analysis across a range of emerging research areas. Emerging, I like that. Including sports sponsorship, video games, and mobile media. He's also worked closely on some of Nielsen's most innovative analysis on overall internet and television usage. I guess you'd be interested in that piece that Jeremy just did as well, Nick. But prior to joining Nielsen, Nick worked in strategic research and marketing for both the EW Scripps Company and ESPN. EW Scripps, now I get it. That's the HGTV folks there. So out of Chicago, without further ado, let's welcome Nick. Nick, it's great to have you here at The Advertising Show. Welcome.
Hey, Ray. Hey, Brad. Great to be here. Thank you for the very kind introduction.
Very good.
I think our Nielsen ratings, Ray, are going up as we speak.
I'm
Nick
plugging
said
the numbers
look
right
into
now.
That for us.
What do you know? There you guys go.
Thanks.
Not quite measuring the podcast just yet.
Can we do a weekly feature with you then? That's what we need.
That's the surest way to. No, I have to say that is not a good way to boost your ratings.
No. Okay.
Mostly, we'll see whether I'm that engaging, I suppose, and we'll talk a lot about engaging.
We're off to a good start here. Brad, what do you have?
Yeah, well, Nick, just to get us started, let's talk a little bit about your job as Director of Cross-Platform Insights for Nielsen. You've managed a wide range of research and analysis across a number of areas. I'm curious, how do you guys determine which areas of interest are going to be studied?
Our business plan and our areas of growth are entirely driven by our clients' interests, right? So we are, at heart, many of us, myself included, researchers who are curious and particularly about the media ecosystem in the U.S. and abroad. And it'd be very easy for us to start researching things that were just of interest to us, but we'd be heading down all sorts of paths which might not be of interest to our clients. Primarily, the areas that we gravitate toward are those areas that have a lot of promise as an advertising vehicle. Video games, still just an emerging advertising platform, but a lot of promise down the road. Obviously, mobile, sports sponsorships, an area that I cover, is an area that we saw that could have even more advertising involved and more sponsorship and done with a higher degree of science than has been done historically. And so it's a very long-term process where we have a pretty good sense what we're going to be looking closely at over the next few years. But it involves a constant dialogue with our clients about what's most interesting and most urgent to them.
Yeah, makes sense. Nielsen recently completed a study entitled Changing Models, A Global Perspective on Paying for Content. Before we get into discussing some of the specific findings, specific in a general sense, I'd like to get a high level from you about the study. For example, survey participants, methodology, et cetera.
Sure. Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So the study that we put out just a couple months back on monetizing online content, people's willingness to pay for online content, was probably the biggest study of its kind in its global scale. We reached out to 27,000 consumers around the globe, 54 countries represented, and we asked them about their attitudes toward paying for different types of online content, their attitudes toward paying for online content in general, and which content types they had already paid for. And what it yielded was a really interesting paper, which is available at Nielsen.com, on the things that we believe, based on this survey, people are going to be willing to pay for in the next few years, things that they told us they'd be willing to pay for. And then the areas that we need to think about, the concerns that consumers have, things like they want to be able to share their content if they pay for it, and things like that that really bubble up very quickly when you ask these consumers how they feel about the subject.
Sure.
You know, I think there were a lot of people speculating. There continue to be a lot of people speculating about as some online content properties realize that advertising alone may not support their business model, that they're going to need to put up paywalls. We were all speculating about how consumers felt about that, and we thought, why not just go out and ask them? So it was an online survey to 27,000-plus consumers, like I said, across 54 countries. And,
that's huge.
And the fact that they are online consumers is important because many of the countries represented are emerging markets where the population of online consumers is smaller, but we thought the most important people to ask would be, of course, those with Internet access.
You know, so often we hear of sample sizes and are suspect of that. 27,000, my goodness, what a wonderful
That's sample. A big number, folks. Yeah really.
Yeah. And you can accomplish good research for it with smaller sample sizes, but when you're looking at getting it across that many countries and when you want to compare one country to another, what it turns out being is you really need at least 500 respondents in every country. And these, I didn't mention the age, but these are all respondents 15 and older.
And, of course, that's relative, I'm sure, to the actual country size itself, and that 500 number would expand or get larger for larger markets such as U.S. or whatever, correct?
Yeah, correct. To some extent it does, and then there's a weighting process at the end of that as well, where we weight the respondents to be representative of the ages of the population that we're trying to capture.
Makes sense. As many probably expected, a majority of consumers, some 85% according to your study, prefer that content remain free. However, as they say, the devil really is in the details when it comes to the type of content consumers would be willing to pay for. Take us through, as you mentioned earlier, some of the type of online content consumers are willing to pay for versus that which consumers are not so ready to pay for.
Sure. What we found, to some extent surprisingly, some not, what we found is that consumers are more inclined to pay for the types of content that have a higher production value perceived, is really how we look at the results. We see that at the top of the list of the content that people have either paid for already or are willing to pay for, we find music, we find theatrical movies, video games, content that is content which they are already paying for offline and to some extent online, and content which has a high degree of production value. If you go to the other end of the spectrum, we find that consumers almost universally are not interested in paying for content that is consumer-generated, things like blogs, consumer-generated video, and to some extent news, perhaps to your chagrin, I should mention, to some extent even news, talk radio, things like that, are content that consumers seem to perceive as having a lower production cost and therefore are less inclined to pay for online.
Wow.
You know, over the years, we've seen magazines and even newspapers, for that matter, attempt to link their paid traditional content to an online paid model with, I should say, varying degrees of success. What did your study find, and what advice would you give those in print media that are struggling with the challenge of revenue generation for their online content?
I think the most exciting takeaway of the study for me was that consumers are willing to pay for some content. If you just ask them up front, do you want to pay for content? Should content be free? Of course they're going to say, and they did say when we asked them, but we had to ask them anyway. They said, no, I don't want to pay for it. No, content should be free. But like you said, the devil's in the details. When we start asking about some of these subjects, we find that the consumers understand there is a trade-off between the value of content. By and large, they understand that something's got to pay for it, either advertising or subscription. Magazines they kind of fall in the middle of that spectrum I talked about earlier. They're not quite up as high as music and games or professionally produced video, but they're not down with blogs and consumer-generated videos, which tells me that in the magazine space in particular, which you know, you guys talked about this a little bit in the open, about the success of magazines online, in the magazine space in particular, we're going to need to have flexible models of monetization. There are going to need to be ways to allow consumers to either access the content through advertising supported means or to access the content through a premium means. That's not an entirely new concept, this idea of having a set of free information and then behind that a paywall.
Sure.
But I think how we have to think about it is that free information and the paywall, there may even be a third tier. There may be what's free available just by showing up to the site. There may be what's available for access if I pay a subscription or a micropayment structure, and what's available in the middle ground if I give you a lot of information about me and allow you to target messages to me from your marketers and your partners that are highly relevant to me. And I think there will be a subset of consumers out there, whether it's for magazines or other types of content, who say, I don't want to pay, but I want more than I get when I just show up, so here's what you should know about me. And here are the types of ads that I want to see. And I think that kind of model has a lot of promise. And then when it comes to paying that third premium tier, I mentioned micropayments versus subscriptions, that's also an important component of having a flexible model of monetization. I think that any online content provider is going to have to think about, how do I enable my customers to either subscribe or to pay on a per piece of content basis? By and large, what consumers told us in this survey on a global scale is that they tend to prefer that micropayment structure, that they tend to prefer the ability to come in and say, this is an article that's interesting to me. I think that they are saying that a bit in spirit more than what's available today,
yeah.
Because there aren't a lot of great micropayment systems available right now, right? But I think that if you give them an easy tool to say, hey, I'll give you 50 cents or 25 cents for this article without entering my credit card number every time, that may well be a successful model.
I'm glad that you asked for Brad's credit card information before we started the show.
Yeah, you entering that in. 25 cents every minute of the
I love it. On the Advertising Show is Ray Schillen, Brad Forsythe, a penniless Brad Forsythe. Nick Covey is our special guest out of Chicago, director of cross-platform insights at the Nielsen Company. And we'll continue. Of course we will, here in just a moment on the Advertising Show.
You're listening to the Advertising Show with Ray Schillen and Brad Forsythe.
Did a headache spoil a day for you? Are you still feeling a little miserable and upset? Well, of course it would have been.
You better believe it. We'll continue here at the Advertising Show with Ray Schillens and Brad Forsythe. Out of Chicago, Nick Covey, Director of Cross-Platform Insights, the Nielsen Company. You know, Nick, your bio has that you work with sport marketing, sports sponsorships and such like that. I think, you know, it's interesting because you don't think of sports marketing as being something new. Obviously, there are new venues and new opportunities, but it goes back to the billboards they used to have out in left field or something many, many years ago when they started. So what is new in sports marketing here?
Yeah, you're spot on. It goes back to those billboards. And my first job at Nielsen, when I joined, I guess now about 5 years ago from Food Network and Home and Garden Television, was focused on those sports sponsorships, and it's been some time since I've been involved with it day-to-day, but the exciting thing that we've done, we're doing at the time, is to start thinking about sports sponsorships, in-stadium sponsorship signage, as having value beyond what is seen in the stadium. To those of us in the media system who are familiar with digital media and audience metrics, it's kind of a surprise that that's not how advertising was necessarily bought and sold, but to a large extent, in-stadium advertising was being sold, off of relationships, a handshake and a beer at a game, but also by saying, here's how many people will cycle through the stadium. I think there's still a lot of room for growth in the sports sponsorship arena if we start thinking about when that program is seen on television, if that outdoor signage is placed appropriately, it has tremendous amount of value on screen. If you start thinking about it just like a product placement, like you think about a product placement in a primetime television show, mm-hmm. There's a lot of value there. And what we've done is tried to start helping our customers monetize that and figure out what the value is every time that sign is seen on TV.
You know, I think the one thing that kills me about sports marketing is the naming of stadiums, and I know that is an incredibly good opportunity for sponsorships. But it just kills me, you know, as opposed to the ballpark at Union Station or the, you know, Fenway Park or something like that, where it's now the Progressive Insurance and car and truck insurance.
I certainly there are purists out there, and it's, you know, the same idea could be applied across model. You know, people who myself included, to, you know, love the purity of a ballpark that doesn't bear a corporate name, but I think what those teams could do a better job explaining to people, and we could all do a better job appreciating, is that those sponsorships are really what is enabling the vast infrastructure improvements to these stadiums. It's enabling the these teams to catch up with the digital age, and these stadiums to catch up with the digital age, and done tactfully is clearly our best advice. And that's another thing that we've done through this research, is to help teams understand and help advertisers understand what the value of that naming right might be, and how you might word it so that it's not intrusive, but it just flows well. You know, my hometown of Cincinnati, the Great American Ballpark, is just a tremendous example of a name that just kind of slips in there without you even realizing it.
Yeah, makes sense. Brad, you had a question.
To weigh my 2 cents on that, I guess it all really goes back to high salaries of athletes these days is really the bottom line that ultimately requires bigger stadiums with suites that can have high charges, as well as seats that are very expensive to sit in, and therefore the amenities of the stadiums today are required by the owners, and therefore the cities are having to, you know, look for sponsorships to be able to afford to build these things, on and on and on. It's but ultimately it's the high price of
I think you're really
where it's all starting
on.
Right.
If these teams and stadiums didn't need the sponsorship, I'm sure they'd go without. But They've been put in a place where the cost of producing a season of Major League Baseball is so great that it's just absolutely required.
I think from a social aspect, too, as well as it relates to sports marketing, you know, the fantasy football leagues, the fantasy leagues and such like that were around a long time ago, obviously, many times before, you know, we had anything that we even knew that we called social media. And in a roundabout way, that's kind of what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose. You know, it's just like sometimes people refer to Cops as one of the first reality TV programs. We might think of fantasy sports as one of the first forms of social media. I think you're exactly right. And certainly in the last few years, as it's become even easier to host a team through fantasy sports, through websites, we've seen the interest in that grow even more so, you know, when it's not quite as much of a time commitment to be involved in such a thing and keep track of such things.
Right.
Well, I think Alan Funk had the first reality show with candid camera, but we could go on and on here.
Yeah.
Hey, let's go back to your research for a second. As you mentioned, 52 countries, 27,000 consumers. I'm curious, let's talk a little bit, if you would, Nick, about the how the global consumer lines up with the U.S. consumer with regard to attitudes towards paying for online content. Is there a difference?
Yeah, so there's a pretty distinct difference that comes out in the paper, and that is that North American consumers in general seem to be the cheapskates of the global population when it comes to paying for online content, at least in how they're describing their interests. Across the board, we see U.S. consumers and North American consumers most inclined to say that the content should remain free, that if I have to start paying for it, I'm going to stop using it. Whereas in other markets, we don't see quite as much outrage at the possibility of paying for content. I think that has a lot to do with the developed nature of our online media environment. I think that we were quick to produce a worldwide web that was filled with content. Most of it was free. And we trained the American consumer and the North American consumer to be accustomed to that freeness. We kind of got ahead of ourselves a little bit before we let the economics play out and figure out, okay, what are the viable business models here? And so we've got a little bit of retraining to do of the North American consumer to say, well, you know, actually, if you want to keep getting this high quality of content, we're going to have to find other ways of monetizing this. That ads alone are probably not going to support the quality of content that you're looking for.
We're going to get a chance to continue our conversation here with Nick Covey out of Chicago, Director of Cross-Platform Insights, the Nielsen Company. But we can take a break here for just a moment with Gene Bliss, our customer experience type person. And Brad, this sounds like the DVD you got last week, Nurse Next Door. No. and this one is called Humble Pie. This will be interesting to listen to. And Gene Bliss here at the Advertising Show.
Welcome to the customer experience, making customers your true priority for a profitable outcome, with your host, author, speaker, consultant, and customer crusader, Gene Bliss.
Nurse Next Door is a home health care service that helps you care for your elderly and sick loved ones at home. Founded in 2001 by John DeHart and Ken Sim, Nurse Next Door was born out of their personal experiences when their caregiver search caused concern as they were repeatedly sent inappropriate candidates. So they decided that when mistakes occasionally happen in their business, that they would send a sincere and heartfelt apology, explaining what went wrong, how they'd resolve the situation, and humbly asking for forgiveness. When they slip up, Nurse Next Door sends a freshly baked pie as part of their apology. And not any old pie. They send a humble pie with a note that says, "We are humbled by our mistake and sincerely apologize for the poor service." Sim and DeHart say, what's wrong with eating a little humble pie, especially when a customer is at stake? The impact of those pies? They spent $1,500 on pies and saved $100,000 in business. Is your humanity oven lit? Can you bake a humble pie? Acknowledging a mistake shows that you're human. Admitting it is hard, but it's what customers crave. Do you have the DNA to say sorry and mean it?
This has been your weekly installment of the Customer Experience with Gene Bliss. Directing transformational customer insights from major U.S. market leaders, Gene is corporate America's change agent. for a new inspirational understanding of today's consumer. To learn more about Gene's books and speaking engagements, or simply how to drive customer profitability for your company, log on to CustomerBliss.com.
Thanks to Gene Bliss at The Advertising Show. Ray Schillens, Brad Forsyth back with Nick Covey out of Chicago, Director of Cross-Platform Insights at the Nielsen Company. I'm sure you've heard of them. Nick, it's a pleasure to have you here on The Advertising Show. Welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be here. That's been fun.
Yeah, there was a great question in your study. Well, of course, there were several great questions in your study, but one in particular.
More importantly, great answers, too. That's a
good, hopefully, yeah. Here. One that caught my attention was the fact that U.S. consumers, if they believed the quality of online content would decline if companies were unable to charge for it, not in a statistical way, but just in a general sense. What did consumers have to say about this, Nick?
Yeah, that's one of those where I wish that in a multi-language 54-country survey I had the chance to do an open-ended and get it done and processed in some time, because we kind of have to read between the lines. But this is to the point that I was discussing earlier about there being some glimmers of hope in our study that consumers understand the economic trade-offs of media, that they still understand that someone's got to pay for it. And I think that we see that in the U.S. and in other countries where we ask, that a majority of consumers understand that if I can't pay for content, if I don't pay for the content, and if nobody pays for the content, then probably it's not going to be as high quality of a content. And they may be okay with that, which is one of the open-endeds I would have loved to ask. I'd like to get a better understanding going forward, and it's certainly a subject we'll be looking at, is to what extent are consumers willing to sacrifice quality of content for that cost. And probably what we'll see is that consumers will segment out. And just as websites need to create flexible models of monetization, we're going to have a better understanding of, okay, here's the segment of consumers who isn't going to pay anything ever for content, but they have this value to advertisers. And then here's the segment of customers who does have the cash and will pay for the high-quality content. But the catch is they don't want to see the advertising, and then how do we reach them? Because they're very likely going to be among the highest prospect targets for advertisers as well. And it's going to just get real interesting and require a lot of segmentation that this survey fails to get into, but hopefully our future ones will.
Makes sense.
You know, Ray and I have been talking for several years now here on the show about how we, as it lines up with what you said last segment, we as consumers find it very difficult to receive something for free and then eventually be charged for it. I think that's the drug pusher business model, by the way. But and we as U.S. consumers, I think, will have resistance and pushback to transitioning from what was once free to eventually being charged for that. And I don't know what it is about others outside of the U.S. culture or business community, however you want to look at it, that would allow that kind of, it's free one day and the next day it's being charged for, to allow that kind of model to be something that's more readily accepted over there versus over here. Any sense for that? Why?
Well, at times I wish I was a political science expert when looking at this data, because I suspect that there are some distinct cultural differences in at least a number of those markets where, more so than in the U.S., you might have to be accustomed to rules changing pretty quickly and having to abide by them. But moreover, I think that why we see a real pop in the U.S. unwillingness to pay for content that they've been getting for free is that we've just been getting a lot more of it. I have the sense that there has been such a wealth of content available to American consumers at no cost for many years now, that it is just the more and more we push that free content, the more and more they are reluctant to pay for it. And other markets that are just emerging in the digital media sphere may not have pushed so much on consumers for free just yet.
Well, we may run long this segment. I want to get your opinions on a few things here before we let you go, Nick. There's been a flurry of rumors flying around that Facebook is considering a subscription model for members to belong to its community. Again, while these are still just rumors, what do you think would happen if a Facebook-like social site, or for that matter, any free social media site began to start charging for users to participate in their social community? Any thoughts on that, Nick?
Well, I think if any really popular site which starts charging for its content is going to immediately create competition. There will be someone out there who creates or at least thinks they've created, the right business model to provide that content and that experience for free. And so I think it'd be a risky move for any site as big as Facebook to do that. But I think that there are sites such as Facebook which people have grown so dependent upon that there will be people who are willing to pay. But what we found in our survey is a consumer said, if I do have to start paying now, I kind of think of this as, won't you please make that experience a little bit nicer? Do something for me to make it, I'll go with you on this journey. I will consider paying you a subscription, but darn it, you better give me something else in return. Don't just turn the paywall on. I think that's a challenge for a lot of content providers. And if a major social network were to start charging, they'd have to think, okay, what is the new application with which I can bring people along and have them actually start paying?
Sure.
And for someone like Facebook or any social network provider, what we're seeing is that social networks are really becoming more and more of a content gateway for consumers. And so I can envision a world where social networks became more of a content gateway and in doing so provided access to certain degrees of content as part of a subscription cost. There are other advancements in the social networking space, and I'm speaking entirely hypothetically, but things with the location-based services that Facebook and others are looking into, I'm sure, where you'll actually be able to use your mobile phone, engage with your social network, and apply your geographical location to that and access information and friends based on where you are. There are already smaller players out there doing this, but that's an additional service for which some people may be willing to pay.
Sure.
Well, Nick, let me get your opinion on one final question before we let you go. Ben Elowitz, co-founder of WetPaint, a platform for social web sites, was quoted recently as saying, "The traditional ways of judging quality in published content are useless in the digital age, although values such as credentials, correctness, objectivity, and craftsmanship are still sacred to many people. The problem is that there's simply not enough to win audiences these days, drive financial success, or for that matter, ensure viability." And he cites the example of the demise of institutions such as Newsweek that proves that the point that he's wanting to make here about measures of success perishing unless they don't move to outdated measures for success, if you will. So do you think he's right, Nick? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's no doubt about it. The measures of quality have changed to include things like time of delivery and geographical relevance of when I'm receiving that information. How quickly can I process the information or the content that you're delivering to me? These are things that content producers even 10 years ago were not thinking about as much as they were on just producing good content. But I guess what might be a fundamental disagreement, and that I believe content is still king, and content is still king by its quality. And I think that compelling content, there's still bundles of examples out in the ecosystem today where people are still being drawn to high quality content, high production content, high production cost content, and they're either paying for it or they're sitting through ads to watch that. I think that we do have to think about how we evaluate the quality of media, and certainly Wall Street is doing this in new ways. But to say that quality is really not as much of an issue anymore in pedigree, when it comes to journalism, I take some issue with that. At the same time, there's no doubt about it. There's been a commoditization of news, and people like Newsweek are the unfortunate losses of that process.
And so the strong survive there, Nick.
Right.
Nick Covey is our special guest, and we are unfortunately out of time. Go to Nielsen.com, and you can find out more about what they do, obviously, if you don't already know that. But Nick, the Director of Cross-Platform Insights at the Nielsen Company, it's been a pleasure having you here today, Nick.
Ray, Brad, thanks very much for your time. It's been my pleasure.
On the Advertising Show, Ray Shellens, Brad Forsythe. There's a little bit more. Stick around. What a great opportunity to meet a very nice guy out of Chicago. It's Ray Shellens and Brad Forsythe and Nick Covey, the Director of Cross-Platform Insights, the Nielsen Company, Nielsen.com. And by the way, the AdvertisingShow.com is powered by, well, it's almost magical. Well, it isn't. It's very logical. It's called Tendency, and it's available exclusively through our web company called Shipple. It's Schipul.com. Ed and his crew do an incredible job for not only the advertising show, but if you go to the website, you'll see a lot of other folks as well, too. So check it out at Schipul.com if you're looking for a website that does marketing. And who isn't? If you're not, there's something wrong. Okay? Next big thing. It's a book. It's a big red book. And its author is William Higham out of London, I understand. And William is going to be our guest next week here at the advertising show, The Next Big Thing. It's kind of cool. And if obviously the book is just about to be released, but we'll get in touch with William here, and we'll kind of get a sneak preview of what the book is all about for you as well. Advertising show, tell a friend, and thanks so much for listening to the advertising show. Is being brought to you by Advertising Age magazine. You can visit online at adage.com. Ray and Brad, back next week. Hope we can be here with you here too. The advertising show is a copyrighted Big Radio Midgets production.
Under pressure? Get creative concepts fast. Run a global pitch on openad.net and gain access to a global brain trust of nearly 11,000 advertising and marketing creators from 125 countries. Simply take 15 minutes to fill out our online brief form and we'll take care of the rest. From world-class agencies to the best independents to the brightest freelancers, openad.net global creatives can deliver creative concepts direct to your desktop in a matter of days. Why not save time, energy, and money by quickly sourcing concepts from the world's brightest creative minds? Visit openad.net and see how we're revolutionizing the way ideas are created and traded. It's simple, it's fast, and it's global. Openad.net, the smarter way to create your advertising from the freshest creative minds on the planet. Visit openad.net today to find out more.